place to have a really special speak with us. Mr. Jamal's just over there in the front row, and he's actually come especially from Canberra all the way to here just for today, just for us, so that's really exciting. Just a little bit of background sort of information on Jupiter, so kind of giving up his time to come and speak to us today. He's actually the Deputy Chairman of the Australian Christian Lobby. And just a bit about the Australian Christian Lobby, they've got a really clear vision for sort of all Christians in general, to ensure that all Christian principles and ethics are accepted and also influence the decisions that we make in society. So it's also in relation to the way we govern, the way we do business, and just in general sort of community and day-to-day life, ensuring that we have Christian ethics, morals and principles throughout that. They also aim to foster a more compassionate and just a moral society by having positive public contributions, and obviously that should be reflective of our Christian faith. Jim actually also served in the Australian Army for 32 years, which I think every single one of us can appreciate, you know, at any level, let alone for that sort of time, 32 years. He's also a really strong defender of traditional marriage, as we know, which also our Orthodox Church is. And he actually went to Syria in 2013, so not too long ago, and just to see what was happening in Syria at the time. And he also saw how vulnerable Christians there were at the time, and sort of related it to Coptic Christians and obviously all the sort of issues that we know our church experiences over there. So obviously he stated as well that if the West sort of doesn't intervene or anything is going to happen, then we could see real disasters sort of happening there, which I mean, we wouldn't sell anything short of that at the moment. We would say that there are some disasters going on there at the moment. So if we can all just give Jim a big round of applause.
Indeed, and it's a great pleasure to be with you. I had the great pleasure of, this is a million years ago, you know, you won't think this time existed, 1980, actually living in the Middle East with the United Nations and living in Syria, in Damascus for 6 months, lived in Israel for 6 months because we had to work on both sides, you know, as they saw it in the conflict, and then working up in Lebanon. And I visited Egypt and, you know, of course, went over there for a week and had a really terrific time. And I certainly really appreciate your culture. I love the fact that you are so strong on family today. And it's something that, and I guess most of you are probably born in Australia here today, but it's something that you can really retain in your culture, you know, as I think it's impacted extremely positively in Australia, is the strength of family and concern for family, maintaining family in your traditions. So I really encourage you to try to, you know, continue that sort of tradition of your fathers, I suppose. As I look out there at all of you, you know, I feel really old, I tell you. I mean, when someone introduces me and said he was in the army for 32 years, I think, boy, that's a long time. They must think I was in the army when we had spears, you know. But it does remind me of a story. I'm a grandfather now, and I was told a story just this week, actually, of a grandfather who's reading a story to his granddaughter. And after he finished, or probably before he was finished, I know grandchildren who are 3 years old, she said, "Granddad," she said, did God make me?" And granddad said, "Yes, he made you." She said, "Granddad, did God make you?" "Well, yes, dear, but a long time ago." And the little girl thought a while, and then she put her hand up and she ran it through the creases on Granddad's face, and she said, "He's getting better at it, isn't he?" You know, I've got the topic up there, being radical for Christ. And you might think that's a bit of a strange topic. Right, or way of calling it. You might think I'm trying to just be catchy, you know, to get you in. But let me tell you, I'm not, you know, because the fact is that Christians have always been radical in the culture that they've been in. We have, throughout history, been countercultural because we bring a truth to the world which challenges the world. So therefore, Christians and the church have traditionally been countercultural. People will always try to paint the church as very conservative, as not with it, but the reality is the church is countercultural. And so I'm going to challenge you tonight, I hope, that thinking of that, you might think about yourselves as radicals for Christ, because that's in reality what the church has always been and is. I mean, even in the Old Testament day, when you think about it, just to give you an example, I have this pile of books beside my bed. The last count, it was 96 books. You believe this? You know, all partly read books. And my wife lives in absolute fear that one night when I'm turning off the light, you know, as I go to sleep, I'm going to knock these books and they're going to kill me. I think she's more worried about the fact they might kill her, but probably the case. But one of these books is a book of famous speeches. And as I opened this book up to read it, the very first speech was the speech of Moses as he came down off the off Mount Sinai brought down with him the Ten Commandments. And here we are, a secular author, and he said something to the effect, I haven't got the exact words with me here, but he said this was the most remarkable speech that at that time in history had ever been brought to a group of people. He said this speech laid out for the first time a pattern of life that was compassionate, that I was caring, it thought for the poor. And I thought, wow, that's a bit interesting, but I'm sure these ancient civilizations of other people probably did that too. So I tried to research a little bit on what the other civilizations around the Middle East at that time were like. And the reality is, it's very hard, of course, to find any information about how they treated the poor, etc. They don't tend to have public servants in those days, so record everything. But certainly, one thing stood out to me, that the only country in the Middle East there that did not have infant sacrifice was Israel as a result of those Ten Commandments. So here we have the first indication of a real radical change as a result of, even at that stage, Old Testament. And then, of course, as we go through, we find in the Greco-Roman days, someone was telling me today, and I wish I remembered the exact figures, but Delphi, which was a town outside Athens in Greco-Roman times, this person said, and it's consistent with what I understand to be the case, that people, historians and archaeologists, have looked into the town and they've analysed the nature of the civilization that was there, the people that were there, the families. They've got down really deep, you know, into how the families and everything were made up. And they found, and this is where I may have the figures slightly wrong, but they're certainly indicative, they found that in these families, there were only two girls in 10 children. Two girls in 10 children. And of course, you know why the reason that was. Because if a girl was born, they took him outside and they left him out there to die. You know, because people didn't want girls. And you might remember in history that it was Christians who went out and collected these kids who were left out. They also left out kids who were deformed, you know. So again, Christianity having at the time a radical effect on the civilization. Wilberforce, of course, you know. What more radical effect than for the term of his life, actually, from when he was a young man, actually being active, an activist against slavery. And people like Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King was active against the racial inequality that existed in the United States, to the point that it actually cost him his life. So Christianity has always been countercultural, and Christianity is full, and has been throughout its history, full of radicals, and we're no different now. We are different. Now, in a sense, Christianity's interest, and certainly my interest and ACL's interest in this activism, is reflected to a large degree in this statement here. In this statement here, and it's by a man called Abram Kuyper. And Kuyper was someone who'd been a pastor in a church, he'd been a theologian and he taught theology, he'd been a journalist, He actually started a university, he started a whole church movement, and he ended up as the Prime Minister of Holland. And he said, there is not a square inch in the whole domain of human existence over which Christ, who is sovereign of all, does not cry mine. And if you know Colson, the fellow who, of course, was involved in Watergate and then started the prison fellowship after he came to Christ, he actually said, if that's the case, he said, then all Christ's followers should be saying yours. And that's really, you know, a good representation of why we have so much activism in the Christian world, because we believe that there's not a square inch in the whole domain of human history over which Christ is sovereign of all, over which he does not cry mine. And therefore, as his people, we need to say yours. And so therefore we have a motivation, an internal motivation, to represent him. And of course, that motivation, and relevant clearly to us in the Australian Christian lobby, means that government's included in that. He didn't say, there's not a square inch in the whole domain of human history except government. And the reality is, if there's anything that actually forms the character of our nations, it is government. I'd love to tell you, and I'd love to think, and you'd probably like to think, that it was the church. But it ain't. Okay? The thing that most forms the character of every nation on earth is its government. And so we should take an interest in that government, because Satan believes that too. And Satan's in there trying to influence it. It's interesting, I was a soldier, as you heard, for 32 years, and when we're thinking tactically, we always think about the fact that you've got to take, in a battlefield, you've got to take the high ground. Interestingly enough, we don't say you've got to take it, you've got to capture it, we say you've got to have the major influence over the high ground. Because if you don't have the major influence over the high ground, you never get the initiative, you'll never win the battle. And the high ground in our nations is government. It's the Parliament House in Canberra. It's the Parliament House here in Sydney. That's the high ground. And we've got to make sure that the major influence over it is not Satan's, but is Christ. Mira, how are you? I knew someone was here to check on me. Mira worked for us for quite a long time, did a great job. You know, the fact that Satan's there, and the fact that Satan's messing it all up, and the fact that it's a battle, is very evident when you think about the fact that Satan's a great deceiver. And so Satan's trying to deny the truth of Christ in this battle to have the major influence over the nations of the world. And if you just think of these couple of examples, of examples where truth is completely perverted by the action of Satan. You know, we say, and we've had Senate inquiries, and we've had prime ministers, and we've had opposition leaders all stand up and say that forced adoption, where children who were born to single mothers, and the mothers were forced to adopt these children out, that forced adoption was terrible for the children because it broke their biological identity. We've had prime ministers stand up and rail against this, as never should have happened. And they're right, it shouldn't have. And yet, at the same time, we're prepared to pass laws which allow surrogacy so two men can have a baby. How's the biological identity of the child ever going to be preserved in that situation? And yet we have those two things running at the same time. Truth perverted. We have, and I live on a property of 59 acres. I tell people I've got 3,000 head, they're all bees, not cattle. But I live on a property of 59 acres. I'm not allowed to cut down a single tree on that property. I've actually planted over 200, right? And I've only cut down one. But I'm not allowed to cut down a single tree because, particularly through the Greens, you know, and this is not a bad thing, we believe that every tree in Australia should be able to grow up in its natural environment. And we have laws to make sure that's the case. But we won't have laws to make sure
that kids can grow up in their natural environment. Truth perverted, you know, because it isn't Christ's influence that's up there in the high ground, it's Satan's. Now the really, really sad one to me, the one that really breaks my heart, is that in the same hospital, if it's the ACT in Victoria, or all Victoria in particular, at the same hospital, at the same time, you can have someone fighting for the life of a baby that's born premature, and at another part of the hospital, you know, that same baby being aborted. How do we reconcile this, you know? Except that Satan's got the perverted truth. So we're in the middle of a battle, and we need to be in there representing Christ. And what about this situation? You know, how's Satan at work there? I'm sure that child's no longer alive. You can't get that skinny and still live. But how would Christ feel when he looks at that? Knowing, as we all do, Christ's special concern for children. So Satan's in there, and Satan and Christ requires us as his people to get in there and bring truth into these situations. You know, the reality is, of course, governments can fix this. Governments can fix this. We produce enough food in the world to fix this. Often, these situations are the result of war. I've been to Somalia during the famines there, and I've seen this sort of thing. And I know that the only reason that it was happening was because thugs were hijacking the UN food convoys, which is why the UN was forced to send in there. But you see, unless there's an influence on governments to say, hey, get off your backside, send some troops out there to stop the thugs stealing the food, then more and more people end up in this situation. It's really important that we influence governments, whether it's the amount of aid that we have in our budget through the Millennium Development Goals, or it's sending troops when they have to be sent to preserve people's lives, it needs to happen. And then, of course, much closer to your community, I'm sure. And while these pictures are of Syria, you know, I well know what the cops in Egypt, of course, are going through. You know, we're not going to stop this persecution unless there's an influence on governments around the world, Australian government, the UN, all governments, to actually do something about these situations. I can't personally see that this will ever be fixed until someone goes in there and gives ISIS a bloody nose. This is just like Europe during World War II. It's just like the Nazis. It's the same thing, doing the same things. That terrible example of the 34 cops who were killed. You know, somebody at some stage has got to do something, but it's going to take activists who are willing to go in there and bring truth into government and make them respond to it. So Satan's out there, and he's contesting this world for Christ. It is a spiritual battle with Christ. It is a spiritual battle. And Christians, really, more than anyone else, should be at the front of the activism. And you as young people, I hope, will have the fire in your bellies to do this. I'm getting a bit old. Okay? But I hope you'll still have the fire in your bellies to do this. And make no advantage, we have an incredible advantage in Australia. Because we have a democracy. I'm sure you must be frustrated. I'm sure you have relatives back there in Egypt who are continually frustrated. I know you are, by the corruption in the government, the way the government works, the biases in the government. And while we have a little bit of that, right, we still have the occasional helicopter ride, for instance, which gets a bit of trouble. But while we have a little bit of that, okay, we have an incredible blessing in the way that our government operates and our ability to influence it, and we should use it to bless other people because Christ would want us to. You know, in Isaiah 1, if you want to do a study one morning, have a look at Isaiah 1 and just read right through it. Certainly read verses 10 to 17. I'm not going to go through the whole lot of them, but you'll find in Isaiah 1 that God actually rails against the church because they've become comfortable. And he said, I even gets to the point where he says, I'm sick of you receiving your sacrifices. He said, what do they mean to me? We're all around you, like Sodom and Gomorrah. See, he doesn't want churches sitting on their seats, on their backsides. He wants churches out there influencing the world. And the best way to influence it, quite honestly, not the only way, but a very important way, I won't even say the best, a very important way to do it, is through influencing governments and the high ground. This is one part of Isaiah 17, Isaiah 1, verse 17, I will show you. Now he says, learn to do right, seek justice, defend the oppressed, take up the cause of the fatherless, and plead the case of the widow. I used to, years ago, when I first started the Australian Christian Lobby, 15 years ago now, people used to say to me in the church, we shouldn't be doing this, you know, separation of church and state, all that sort of stuff. But just read this, you know, learn to do right, seek justice, okay? Defend the oppressed. You know, there's only two places we can defend the oppressed. That's in courts of the nation and the parliament. Okay? If we're going to defend them. Take up the cause of the fatherless. Plead the case of the widow. You can only take their cause up, you can only plead their case in the courts of the nation and in the parliament. So I suggest to you that there's no suggestion in what God says about a separation of church and state. It's a fantasy in our minds, a fantasy that the devil likes to employ to stop Christians from getting in there and influencing the character of the nation, the character of policy. One lady in the UK, distressed at the fact that the church, though, which is such a big constituency. I know these figures, but I heard them again today. We had a meeting with a whole lot of politicians today and Christian politicians. And the fellow we had giving one of the talks said, do you know, he said, all the people, or all the spectators of all the major sports, all put together in Australia, do not nearly amount to the number of people who attend church every Sunday. Now, those people who attend church every Sunday, right, actually try to influence the political space. Do you reckon the politicians would be game enough to not do what they want to do? Of course they wouldn't. Right? They listen to the sporting people. Right? But the church has it. And this lady in the UK said, for years, the church has spinelessly gone along with this wider judgmental culture of self-gratification, which has turned morality on its head and undermined the cultural foundations of this nation. She was talking about England, even though it was in the Australian. But it's true here as well. The church has spinelessly gone along with it. And it is simply not the Christian response, because the church has always responded like activists in a radical way with faith and courage in these situations. And we've got to revitalise it. We've got to get it again. There are a lot of reasons for this. They're not excuses in any way. One of them, which is perhaps reflected in this statement, is that we seem to, and I think churches in particular seem to, just want to avoid conflict. And the devil says, you beauty. They don't want to avoid, if they want to avoid conflict, you know, that's terrific. But see, Christ's truth is in conflict with Satan. We can't avoid it if we're going to stay true to Christ. The church, of course, and I heard a very distinguished Christian statesman get up at a conference once and said, you know, he said, the church mustn't say anything that might see it perceived negatively. And I thought, boy, that's good. You know, everybody wants to be loved. Don't we all? But, you know, that's not the history of the church. Martin Luther King was perceived so negatively as he went about just trying to overturn this racial inequality that they shot him. Bonhoeffer was perceived so negatively in Germany, not only by Hitler, but by the Lutheran Church, which had Nazi flags hanging in its churches, that Hitler hung him. Wilberforce was perceived so negatively by people who said, oh, we get rid of the slaves, then we're going to go broke, that he was driven almost to death. And what about the apostles? We believe by tradition that all of them were martyred except John. People of the world thought pretty negatively of them. And what of Christ? You know? What did they say of Christ? They said, crucify him, crucify him, crucify him. Can't just stand back, you know, We can't just lack courage if we're going to represent Christ in this world and be radicals on his behalf. It's particularly important too, as we do this, that we remember that the whole idea of democracy, and the only reason democracy works, is because it's run by Christian people. If we allow our democracy to be taken over by people who have no foundational moral base for what they believe, except what's good for them, democracy isn't going to work. And that's evident in these statements by these two people, of course, who were in America, and they're at the foundation of the American democracy, on which ours is largely based, along with the British. And George Washington said, of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. Right? Not optional, indispensable. And Benjamin Franklin said, our constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. I just ask you to think, you know, back to the governments, largely in the Middle East, I know also in Egypt, you know, with the limitations they put on people's freedoms. See, if you don't have people who are operating on a Christian basis of relationship with each other, you can't give a country freedom. And the reason democracy works is because it's Christian people reacting to each other, right, and to their responsibilities along the model of Christ's forgiveness. It's the only reason that would work. I often tend to think that we just don't believe in Australia that we have a big God, you know. We seem to think God's just small and he can't do these things, and so we hide away, you know, from this context. But I mentioned to you the fact that I was in the Middle East, in Lebanon and Syria with the United Nations. And when I was there, I was the United Nations unarmed observer. If you want a job, it's a really dumb job, but go and be an unarmed observer in Lebanon. It's a real dumb job. And they especially give you a big blue beret, so if people get sick of shooting at each other, they can find you real quick. It's dumb. Well paid, but dumb. And I was there doing this dumb job, and one of the things that we had to do was, sometimes we were on the border between Israel and Lebanon. Obviously there we're trying to stop or report the PLO on arms, so report the PLO as they're going down through into Israel, or trying to get to Israel, and we're calling up the armed UN force and they go and intercept them. Funnily enough, most of the time these PLO, they wanted to be intercepted, you know. They'd had the big send-off party and trumped around as heroes, and now they wanted to get caught so they wouldn't have to die out on the other side. It was really a crazy situation. But the other end, when you're up on the Lebanese side, where the PLO camps were, our job varied from just trying to stop whoever was fighting that day. So the PLO might be fighting the UN, the PLO might be fighting the Israelis, or often the PLO factions were fighting each other. And whoever was fighting had to go and stop them. It's like walking out there with a big whistle on a football field, except everyone's shooting. And another thing that we had to do was, when the Israelis shelled or bombed, as they often did, sometimes daily in a week, the refugee camps, then we would have to go and report that and report the casualties, because clearly that's a violation of the UN ceasefire. And I was in one morning just trying to find out what had happened overnight. We'd usually go to the Red Crescent because they'd been around picking up sort of pieces during the night. At night it was just so confused you couldn't tell what was happening generally, and you wouldn't go out there unless you had a specific job to go and try and save someone one way or another. I actually had to go out one night and save an Australian journalist, or save. I had to negotiate his release from the PLO who caught him. And I often think these days, as now I'm in the Australian Christian lobby, I went out and saved an Australian journalist. Ah, can't believe I did it. But I was in talking to the Red Crescent, and a couple of shells landed in a nearby Palestinian refugee camp, artillery shells, and I heard them land, and they got the call on the radio straight away. Of course, they were speaking Arabic, I couldn't understand it. And when they got off, I asked them what happened. They said, well, two shells landed, one in this particular camp, one killed an old man, and one hit a car in which a mother and daughter were travelling, and killed the mother and daughter. And knowing that we had to report this, they said, look, you come in with us, you can report it. Now, I know all you are very familiar with the scenes we see in the press in particular, and you might have seen them at first hand, or certainly your parents might have, of Muslim funerals, you know, where the cask is bubbling along in a sea of emotion. Right? And I know you'll appreciate that to go there, if you can be at all linked to the death of the person in that cask, is not a bright thing to do. And so what we would do, because, and again, you're probably familiar with this, that after 72 hours, because they always bury the dead very quickly, the emotion, for some reason, just drops right out of the situation. And so in that situation, we couldn't affect it, and then we'd wait the 72 hours, go in, and, 24 hours, they buried, but, and then we'd wait a little bit more than that. We'd go in, find out what happened, and report it back to the UN. But these fellas said, no, you come in with us, you'll be right, because we're the ambulance, you know. It's like me saying, you, I'm from Canberra, trust me. And stupidly, I decided that we would, so we went in with them, we followed them in our UN jeep, in behind their ambulance, and when we got into this refugee camp, 1,500 people just closed in around us, angry people. And remember, I'm wearing an Australian flag here, and Australia's one of the five countries at that stage voting against the Palestinians in the UN. And so we got in there, they jostled us out of the car, they jostled us up to a hall in the middle of the refugee camp. And as I'm going up the steps into the hall, the car in which the mother and daughter had been killed was just off to the side of the steps, right beside it. And as I'm going up the steps, I'm actually at the top of them, a young fellow grabs me by my sleeve, pulls me down the steps and pushes my hand into the blood on the car. And he's clearly saying, yeah, this is your fault, mate. Probably wouldn't have said mate, but this is your fault, you know. You stop us getting in there, but you don't stop this happening here. And I can understand the perspective, I tell you. Now, I've been up there every day. But I wasn't really interested in dying for it. And they took us into the hall, and, you know, as you're familiar with, there's a low concrete seat right around the sort of reception area. And, oops, come on. And everybody's very subtle. Everyone usually very welcoming, as Middle Eastern people are, but very, very subtle. And as we sat there, there was a room just off there, like behind your secondary altar, like not altar, sorry, what do you call it?
Sanctuary.
Oh, yeah, sanctuary. Like your second sanctuary there. And inside it was a group of leaders from the Palestinian terrorist group that were in there, and they were arguing about whether or not they'd execute us in retribution for this for these people being killed. Now I'll tell you, I'm no hero at all. In fact, my wife's a doctor, and I have to sometimes get drops in my eye, and I'm the biggest coward, you know. I've actually commanded the SAS regiment. This hasn't been recorded, you know, but I've commanded the SAS regiment, but I hate drops in my eye. And so when my wife goes to put them in, I have my eyes apparently closed like this, my tongue out like this, and apparently I'm like every two-year-old and four-year-old she gets in the surgery each day, and so she knows what to do. What she does is she drops the first drop on your tongue, and she drops it on my tongue, and I go, ah! And then she goes, chuchu. So I'm not the bravest man around. But I was sitting there, and I'm thinking, well, what are we going to do now? You know, if this is one of the games you'd like, so I'm sure the ladies probably play, it'd be easy, wouldn't it? You just shoot up, there's only 1,500 of them, knock them all over and walk out there, you know. But it wasn't a game, you know. And so all I could do was actually remember the words in Isaiah 40, you know. And if I bottom line, I can't. Does someone have a Bible? I'm sorry, or pull me Isaiah 40. Isaiah 40, verse 12. And in Isaiah 40, verse 12, we really get an idea of how big our God is, you know. And it's a notion, it's an image that all of us need to carry around if we're going to be activists for God. If we're going to go out there and take the devil on, we and try to bring Christ into this high ground, we really have to know that our God is this big.
Thanks very much. That's right. Yeah, that's good.
And it says, who's measured the water in the hollow of his hand? Right. This is a big God. You know, all the waters of the earth, that he's got them in the hollow of his hand. And heaven with a span. Right? I love this one because every year, even this week, I think the scientists have told us there's more heavens. And God says, it's all right, I've got them. Don't you like that? Be God. Be God. That's too right, we've got it. And who's weighed the mountains on scales? And the hills in a balance. Right? Imagine God standing there with all the mountains of the world on a balance. Right? Well, this one I have lost. But you can see the images that are coming into my mind and reminded me how big our God is. You know? And I must admit that just thinking about how big our God is, I just had incredible peace come over. And after some hours, it's probably no more than 12 hours, they actually just let us go, which I found amazing, because 6 months later they tortured to death and hung my boss. They'd killed three Fijians just a few weeks before, these guys and me. But they just let us go. And it just made me realise, and the interesting thing to me was, you know, God didn't rescue us by sending in legions of angels. He could have. He didn't rescue us by sending in the SAS regiment. He could have, you know. But what he did was he changed hearts. And I just want to encourage you that we as Christians, you know, have a real incredible advantage in this spiritual battle that we're in. And that is that we have the power of God behind us and running through us. And all we've got to remember is how big he is. I'm going to slip over a lot of this because I can see my time has gone, and I'm not going to keep you here all night. I know you'd be quite happy to do that, of course, if I was to talk to you. But I want to finish by just saying to you how you can be activists for Christ. Okay. Some of the ways you can be activists for Christ, okay? Australian Christian Lobby actually has a website called Make a Stand. And on that website, you can actually get on there, and even if you don't know who your politician is, you simply put in your postcode, and whammo, all your politicians come up. If you dig deeper into the site, you'll find that there's information there on the various issues. You can whack off a quick email to your politicians and just send it off. Right? Real easy. And see, the thing is that in a democracy, what matters is numbers and opinions are numbers. The gay lobby's got this same-sex marriage issue to the point that it's got because it's more committed than we are. Isn't this terrible? It's more committed than we are. It's minuscule but more committed than Christ people. So I'd really encourage you on not just that, but on a whole range of issues to perhaps look at this Make a Stand and see if you might use it and put a Christian view out there. In that regard, there is one particular one on marriage at the moment. There's a petition there you might like to sign, right, which just registers the weight of opinion of people who believe in marriage should be between a man and woman as God intended it to be. I'm afraid it is absolutely true that God didn't create Adam and Steve, he created Adam and Eve. And it is true. I'd really encourage you to get onto Facebook. You know, Facebook's a really tough thing to be on. I realise that, you know, if you put a Christian view out on Facebook, you'd probably get slammed. But we've got to stand up. Right? Your people in your country are getting killed. The saddest thing I've ever seen is a picture from the Middle East, and it was in Syria, and it was a group, very small group of people walking down the street, and they're holding a banner with a small group of Christians behind it, and it said, and it's saying to the West, your silence is killing me. You'll understand that from your tradition. Your silence is killing me. You know, it's killing the babies in the womb too. It's messing up kids who end up in weird family arrangements that they shouldn't, that God never intended. Get on Facebook and represent Christ. One thing the Australian Christian Lobby tries to do is to facilitate events that can inform people, that attract a crowd, and therefore politics knows Christians are thinking about these things. This is one that's on in the 19th of August in Sydney. The young fellow there on the left, happy to see, he's probably at least 30 years. He is 30 years younger than I am. And he's a heck of a lot smarter. He works for the Heritage Foundation in America. His name is Dr. Ryan Anderson, and he is just brilliant, just brilliant. And I'd really encourage you to think about going along to that and being there in the audience, because you'll be educated by what he has to say, and you'll also be representing Christ just by being there in the audience. One I really want to talk to you about is the Lachlan Macquarie internship. Just looking around the audience, I assume a lot of you are in university already, maybe in the later years of university. And this course is a 3-month intensive living course. It's for people who have already got their first degree, but who are going into a career which is going to influence public policy. So that might be, for instance, and we look particularly, but we're not exclusive on this, on law, politics, public service, or media. And this 3-month course, we've had 70 people go through this course. It is so good. Not one person, even though we make a living for 3 months, right? Not one person's ever pulled off. And we haven't got a firing squad there or something. It's all voluntary. But what it does is, it teaches, and we don't, it's not us like Jim Wallace out there teaching it. It's fellows who are professors at universities. The one on the top there is probably Australia's leading constitutional lawyer, Professor Nicola Rainey from Queensland University. And they come and live in for a week or 2 weeks. But it teaches biblical foundations, so we know why we believe what we believe. Historical traditions in Christianity over time, modern thought, and religion and politics in Australia. So it is a really good course if you're looking at going into a career that might influence public policy. As well as that, we also take people into the parliament for a week. They're attached as an intern to a Christian politician. And a lot of them have got jobs out. In the last lot that went in, there are only 6 on the course, I think, and 7 on the course, and 2 of them got offered jobs. We've now got over 20% of our graduates working as staffers in politics right around the country. And this has got to have a good influence in time, because some of them become politicians in time. And we'll have those good people on the hill. You'll also get to actually dine with dinner guests who are quite amazing Christians who've actually learned how to juggle being a Christian and in a high profile position in the world. So this one is Michael Jeffrey, former Governor General of Australia. And in fact, the young lady just near me in the red dress here is a Copt, actually. She's Dahlia is her name, and she's from West Australia. And she was our first Copt on the course, actually. Now, another one, which for those of you who might be a bit younger and perhaps about to leave school or already in your first degree at university, we have a gap week, which is run just for a week, as the name suggests. And this is really about trying to bulletproof young people as they go into university or while they're in university. Now, it's really important we understand our Christian worldview and how to defend it. And that's what this course is all about. And it has many of the same lecturers as I just showed you for the main course. But I really encourage you, if you're finding it hard to be apologist for your faith in university, come along to this. You'll really enjoy it. Being there with a whole lot of other young people as well. So how do we impact government for Christ? How do we become radicals for Christ? Well, we've got to pray for government. The Bible tells us to pray for government, right? We've got to, you can become a supporter of ACL, you don't have to be, but you can become a supporter of ACL and you receive weekly news, e-news, that'll tell you what's going on in the world. Because when we don't receive the stuff, we just don't realise what's going on, and there's a lot going on. You can attend that Lachlan Macquarie internship or the Gap Week. You don't need to worry about the next one. You can follow us on Facebook, and you can become a Christian activist on Make a Stand. I'd really encourage you to do that. Have a look at this Make a Stand. There is an ACL app you can download, and that'll probably achieve all those things in one. And I'd really encourage you to do that. This was a quote out of a book called Roots for Radicals. I don't necessarily endorse all of the theology of this Roots for Radicals, but it has some really good things about how to be a radical as a Christian. And it explains the role of Christian radicals in this way. It says there are two worlds, the world as it is and the world as it should be, the way God would want it to be. And embracing this tension is our spiritual destiny. In other words, we as Christians just can't sit here and get richer, can't sit here and get comfortable, you know. We're here because every square inch in the whole domain of human existence over which Christ is sovereign of all, he cries mine over. And we should be crying yours. And it's necessarily intentional. Satan's on the other side pulling at it. So God bless you. I hope you found that interesting. I've really enjoyed being here with you. I'm quite happy to take questions, Anthony, depending on how you want to run the show, or if I've gone well over my time, which I probably have, then you're welcome to shut me up.
No. Thanks much, Simon. Does anyone have any questions for you?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So historically, like in Poland, communist countries,
yeah,
like the former Soviet Union, mm, and there is China,
mm,
like they encourage all politicians who are part of, who are members, they encourage them to become atheists.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Really good. Yeah. Or sorry, do you have another part of the question?
I know.
No. Okay. So the point is, and it's a really good point, is that in communist countries, particularly, that politicians are certainly encouraged to become atheists, but of course the whole population in those countries has been too, in Russia and in China, haven't they? And in both of them, many forms of religion, certainly all forms in China, and many forms in Russia, except the Orthodox Church, which was very restricted, were forbidden. Now, it's interesting to make that point, you know, because when people say to us, as I increasingly hear, and you'll hear more and more, the church is responsible, religion is responsible for all these problems. You know? Religion isn't responsible for all the problems in the world. Religion has ameliorated all the problems in the world. And you only have to point to China, to Russia, right?
Even to Cuba.
Yeah, to Cuba. But if you just look at China and Russia, and you look at how many people died under atheist regimes, I think it's 100 million altogether between those two. 100 million in the last century, okay? 20th century. And so, just put that back to people when they say this to you. Because when you have an atheist regime, you know, then there's no foundation on which moral decisions are made except the strongest people. And so I'm glad you raised that, because it's a really good argument, you know, for having nations, you know, center themselves around Christian values. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, like also in China as well.
Yeah.
And I know that there are religious groups like the Falun Gong, and
yeah,
also like people who are Tibetan.
Mm.
Tibetan Buddhists, they get persecuted.
That's right.
Because of their beliefs.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Because communist systems, you know, are afraid of people with belief. And it's largely, I think, because, you know, they have a reason to actually push back. Yeah? The very radicalism I'm talking about, which is inherent in a Christian faith, to oppose, you know, evil. And these atheist regimes are inherently evil, hence 100 million people killed.
Sorry, there's another one. Yeah.
Wanted to ask, as Christians and as Australians, where do you draw the line between us promoting like the Christian values, biblical values, and accepting a democratic society that's pluralistic in its values?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Where I draw the line is that I don't believe we're meant to step outside the governance. You know? You think even of Christ. You know, Christ allowed himself to be crucified. In other words, he in the end, he acknowledged the Roman governance of the country. But he didn't bend a knee. Right? And I've got to say to you that, you know, it's interesting that the Archbishop, the Catholic Archbishop of Chicago, said only a few years ago, and at the time I thought that's a ridiculous statement, that is really an overstatement, but this is what he said. He said, "I will die in my bed. My successor will die in jail, and his successor will be executed." Now that's amazing. That he's talking about in America. And I thought, that is just so ridiculous, that it is so alarmist. But let me tell you, that's the way it's heading. I would never have thought that the situation in America, with its attitude to faith, you know, with now what's turned into not just a disdain for faith, but a persecution of it, would have occurred in so short a time. But it has. And so, I think that, but I think our response to that, I might say, is to be Christ-like in our response. I think the incredible witness that your 34 martyrs had there in Egypt, you know, is the sort of response. It's easy for us to say when we're not there being martyred, but it's the sort of response that has much more effect than us raising up an arms against, and particularly in Australia. With a democratic country, I think we've just got to continue to try to bring Christ's influence in. It's what the early church did, you know, and it took 300 years. But after 300 years of persecution, the whole of the Roman Empire was Christian. Okay? Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you said you encouraged us to be Christian radicals,
Yeah, I think that's a good question. The question was, for those who didn't hear it, that, you know, when I talk about being Christian radicals, it's a word which, is, of course, usually has negative connotations, but is there such a thing as a reasonable radical? It's a really good way of putting it. Yes, I think there is, you know, and the whole point is that a radical is, to me, you know, somebody who is viewed as radical because their views, their way of living, their response to things is so different to the normal. That's a radical. A radical doesn't mean it's somebody who picks up, as we see with ISIS, you know, the sword and starts running around cutting people's heads off. But a radical instead is someone who has views and character and values that are so different to the world around them. And certainly the way in which I'm trying to use it here. And what I'm trying to say to you is that the history of Christianity has to be that people have been that. You know? They have brought Christ to the world, and it is invariably, you know, counterintuitive to the world. We went through when I was a young fellow, those many, many years ago when armies had spears, the reality was it was easy to be a Christian. I was born in 1951 and grew up, even through the 60s, it was still easy to be a Christian. Most people went to church, I'd say. No, it's probably not right, but a large proportion of the population went to church. It was just everyone did it, you know. Now, totally different. A lot harder to be a Christian. And so more and more our views, and if you think about what I said about the Archbishop of Chicago, more and more our views are going to be seen as radical. You know?
but we've got to stand up for them nonetheless. There's a fellow who I read each morning, or try to read each morning for my quiet time, and he makes the point, you know, that we all talk about wanting to follow the footsteps of Christ, you know. But see, the footsteps of Christ are not the footsteps that we see on that idyllic poster of a beach in North Queensland, where you just see the beach and the nice water lapping in, and you see footsteps along the beach. That's not the footsteps of Christ. Okay, the footsteps of Christ, as your people know, perhaps more than any others, are blood-filled footsteps, and they lead to the cross. And praise God that hopefully none of us in this room will ever have to go to the point of martyrdom. But we have to accept, you know, that a little bit of sweat, a little bit of blood is going to be required by all of us into those footsteps of Christ that we're going to follow. Any other questions? Now, they must have coffee after this, do they? Well, look, I've really enjoyed talking to you. Brilliant questions. Every question are brilliant questions. So thank you very much indeed. And God bless you all, and God bless your church.